Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies. I am Crawford Gribben, the host of the channel. Today we're going to be talking to Stephanie L. Derrick, an historian from Los Angeles, about her new book, The Fame of C.S. Lewis, A Controversialist Reception in Britain and America, which has just been published by Oxford University Press. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Crawford.
Thanks for taking time out of what I believe is quite a busy international book tour.
Yes, it is. I've been gone from home for quite a while now. We started in the UK, and I spoke at the National Library of Scotland. Then I went over to Ireland, spoke at the National Library of Ireland, and then on to New York, Chicago, Toronto, and now I'm in Boston.
That's great. The range of cities that you've just mentioned there gives us some indication of what a subject of interest C.S. Lewis continues to be.
Yes, I think so. That's what I'm finding. I'm finding that people are really interested in just hearing a new perspective on Lewis. A lot of the work that's been done on him has been, well, some of it's been good, but much of it has been out of admiration of Lewis himself. And I kind of take a different angle and try to give us a historical perspective on the man and him and his within the context of his time, Oxbridge in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And then I go on to look at his fame, really, from within his lifetime and then forward to today.
That's great. We'll get to the content of the book in just a second, Stephanie. But first of all, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm originally from Jackson, Mississippi, and I did graduate work at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, and then at the University of Stirling, I did my PhD there in history. And sort of the kind of background for why I wrote this book is that, growing up in American Christian subcultures, Lewis's name is floated around quite a lot. He's mentioned from the pulpit. Everybody seems to have read Mere Christianity or Given It Away. And that was just kind of part of what I was familiar with in my kind of cultural circles. And then in graduate school, I was taking a class on the history of evangelicalism. And the professor, who's at Harvard Divinity School, he mentioned, he being from Belfast, and also, which is also Lewis's hometown, he made this comment that he found that American interest in Lewis was pretty high compared to his home country. And he was probably referring to the 80s and 90s because it's peaked a little bit more since that time. So, but anyway, this really interested me because I wanted to know, well, that's interesting. Why are compared to people in his home country? So that's what kind of kicked off this what became a 10-year project into looking at Lewis's reception.
Fascinating. I think one of the most interesting things about your book is the way that it looks behind C.S. Lewis as an individual to think about the concept of fame and reputation. When we talk about C.S. Lewis, what is it we're talking about? Is it an individual or is it something else entirely?
That's interesting. Well, I think it depends on who you ask. I mean, I think like with anybody, you can get a sense of the man himself. He is certainly, he was a person, and we can get to know a lot about him through his writings. But of course, with anybody, you can only get so far with what they've actually written. And it helps to get, for example, what other people said about that person. And in Lewis's case, there's quite a lot of people talking about Lewis in his lifetime and beyond. So that was an advantage to me as a historian to get beyond just what he has said to what others have said about him. But that's just two pieces of the puzzle. Then you have to go beyond that and look at, well, what is his context? What is he responding to? Why is he doing what he did? And so that's another piece of the puzzle. And so, and then another, I would say, beyond that is readers' responses to Lewis and their context. So there, you have to kind of pull together a lot of pieces before you can kind of feel like, well, is this a perception of Lewis? Is this Lewis himself? You know, it's a complicated matter. And I think we're always guessing. We never can get to the real man. And that's okay. That's fine. History is a interpretive game. And that's where the art is. And so that was what was fun about kind of looking back at, okay, what's been written about him and where is this, you know, just what the reader wants him to be rather than an engagement with as much as we can find about what was actually happening in his lifetime.
Oh, fascinating. Well, one of the things your book is very good at doing is showing the way in which there's a distinction between the C.S. Lewis who was operating within his own lifetime and the C.S. Lewis that's being sold after his death. And although I've been reading Lewis for many years, I've never really thought about that distinction in the way that you present it illuminatingly. And I think the thing that really struck me about your work was the way in which some of the stuff that's posthumously published shapes the reputation of Lewis in a way that it could never have done during his own lifetime, where he exercised great control and care over what it was that he put into print.
Yeah, that's right. During his day, you know, Lewis kind of talked a big game about not caring about what other people thought about him and not giving too much thought to, you know, his own reputation. But of course he did care. He did read reviews of himself and he did, you know, write blurbs and pick out photographs of himself. He did manage his own reputation. But of course, yes, as you mentioned, he dies and from 1963, when the date of his death, he's no longer in control. And that control is handed on to other people. First, it was, you know, Walter Hooper, who was, and Warney, his brother, who were in charge in the 60s and 70s of Lewis's estate, managing his estate, managing which books were reprinted with in collaboration with the publishers, looking for new, you know, Lewis material that they could market and keep his name in among the public's perception, keep his name before the public. And then that power transferred again to his stepsons who gained control in the early 80s of the C.S. Lewis and created the C.S. Lewis estate. And that C.S. Lewis estate was in charge from the early 80s to today of Lewis's image. And one of the things that's interesting is that they really pushed the Narnia books because the Narnia books were the ones that could reach a mainstream audience. They were the big money makers. And, you know, you'll know that today Lewis is best known for the Chronicles of Narnia. And that's not wholly to do with the fact that the Lewis estate pushed those books, but it is partially to do with that. And, yeah, so it's kind of a complicated story from the time that Lewis died forward as to what is remembered and why it's remembered. In Britain, Lewis is first famous in the 40s. to a place first becomes known to a popular audience during World War II, at the height of war, because the BBC asked him to do a radio broadcast. And this is at a time when everybody is tuned in to the radio because it's critical to get updates about the war through one's radio. And therefore, if it was hoped, and it actually happened, that a lot of people would stay tuned after the war broadcast to listen to, say, for example, a talk about Christianity by C.S. Lewis. So he really became famous during the wartime, that together in with his publication, The Screwtape Letters. And so that's Britain. In America, he becomes famous at the same time as a Christian apologist, but really kind of more the late 40s. There's a small group of people who know about him in the early 40s through Screwtape Letters. And then when he's on the cover in 1947 of Time magazine, that really ups his profile. And so he also has an American profile and some publicity as a Christian apologist. So he's first known really as a theologian for the layman, for explaining Christian theology in plain man's terms, so to speak. And then the Chronicles of Narnia were really a surprise publication from an author is just known as a scholar, a medievalist, and a populist of theology. There's a funny quote, if I can find it. Anyway, I'll sum up his publisher. His editor at Macmillan in New York writes to him. He's like, well, you know, these children's books, they're fun and all, but could you get back to writing the religious apologetics that we're all expecting of you? You know, so that kind of gives an indication, like the Chronicles of Narnia were really a surprise. And for Lewis, they were really a relief from he kind of tired of writing Christian apologetics at that point. And some of that was just exhaustion from writing back to Christian fans who were writing to him about Christian apology at an enormous level. And he had to keep up this enormous post. And he got tired of writing about Christian theology. And I think that the Narnia books are kind of a relief to him, a return to first loves of literature, of Edwardian children's literature, of magic. So that's during his lifetime. And then, but because the Narnia books are more appealing to a broader audience, they are the one, and because they are more adaptable to media, so television and movies, they are the ones that he became known for after his death, better known for. But that's not to say that he wasn't known for his Christian apologetics as well, still, especially in America. In America, there continued to be a real love of his Christian books, and they continue to be very useful because as Christians in America were participating in, say, universities, for example, they were reaching for his books as a way of, you know, explaining themselves to, you know, your new philosophy professor as an undergraduate who's challenging your beliefs on, you know, creation, for example, whatever it is. People would often turn to Lewis in those cases because he was accessible and he was well known. In Britain, on the other hand, there's really a moment of kind of poo-pooing Lewis, especially in like the 60s. And the 70s. And that's kind of a complicated situation. He's loved in the 40s in a popular way. After that point, the 60s happen, and he's always a more complicated figure in Britain. There's always a strain of criticism in Britain that doesn't exist to the same degree in America. But after the 60s, his kind of old man Western persona of a kind of backwards looking big masculine figure isn't, it's not striking the right tone in Britain. They're wanting to move forward. The culture is tired of hearing old white men, you know, talk about the past. So it, he really isn't the cultural fitting in the cultural moment post-60s as far as his serious works go. So that's a change. And whereas in America, that's a really interesting contrast, because American Christians in particular are bemoaning this sense of loss of cultural hegemony and dominance. They're losing out their mainstream voice. They're losing to secularization in the mainstream media, for example. And for them, Lewis is still kind of a hero of the faith because he has the big credentials of being associated with Oxford. You know, there's a lot of Anglophiles in America, the Tweed, the Pipe, you know, this is all quite appealing. His association with Tolkien, this is all kind of a romantic, wonderful thing, and serves a good purpose, or a purpose, for American Christians. In Britain, even British Christians are still kind of uncomfortable with Lewis's persona, which I go into in the book at quite depth, because it's a little bit difficult to summarize kind of a complicated persona that he puts on. But the British Christians and British readers pick up on this persona at a degree that the Americans don't. So yeah, that's quite a long ramble, but I hope I'm getting my point across.
Oh, fascinating, fascinating. You talk a lot about Christians in your response there, Stephanie, but really I suppose what you're referring to is evangelicals, isn't it? It's evangelicals mostly in America who pick up on Lewis, is that right?
American evangelicals are loud in their devotion. They're not the only ones. There's quite a few Catholics that are following him. Depends on kind of the use. American evangelicals are the ones that are the most devoted fans. They're the kind of loudest and most earnest, but they're not the only fans. I mean, he's useful. Like Screwtape Letters would have been used widely among many kinds of Christians. Sure. Same for American Christianity. So, but you're right. American evangelicals are the most devout, and they're the loudest about Lewis.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the structure of the book? You've got a massive topic here, the fame of C.S. Lewis. How did you decide to approach that topic?
Well, I tried to be narrative about it. I tried to follow some kind of chronology to make sense of this very complicated topic. So I start with Lewis himself and the question specifically, why did he write for a popular audience? Why did he try to reach a mainstream audience? And that I don't feel should be taken for granted. I mean, it wasn't every scholar of literature that was doing that. And Lewis himself was criticized in his day for taking time to try to basically persuade a popular audience of his views on Christianity. That was a controversial move. So I went back and asked why is he doing that? What are his motivations for that? And that starts off the book. And then I take another lens on Lewis and I say, okay, what are his peers thinking of what he's doing and of he himself? What is their reaction to Lewis at Oxford and at Cambridge and just the literati generally? What's their view? Then I move on to kind of talk about, okay, so that's, we have Lewis himself, we have his peers. What about just everyday people? What do they know about Lewis at mid-century in Britain and America? And were there differences at mid-century? And then I move on to try to think about, okay, well, what happened socially? What are the big kind of movements in the 20th century that had a bearing on why we know the name of Lewis today? And, you know, that was media, changes in media, changes in publishing, and also cultural changes. Okay, so then I move on to talk about, okay, well, how does Lewis's image move within that? And what happens in Britain and America comparatively to this complicated figure in very, you know, vastly quickly changing and dramatically changing times of the 20th century. And then I kind of bring it up to speed and to the early 2000s and look at, well, this is an ever-evolving situation because actually American fascination with Lewis is now re-influencing British perceptions of Lewis.
Yeah.
So British Christians, I found, who had interviewed them, they were often saying, well, we're listening often to somebody like Tim Keller, and Tim Keller is a big Lewis fan, and he's quoting Lewis a lot. So we're thinking, well, okay, maybe we should look at this guy again. So that influences his kind of resurgence, like a resurgence or a slight resurgence or kind of a new interest in Lewis in more recent years.
Fascinating. Your first chapter begins by discussing Lewis as an Ulster contrarian. What do you mean by that?
Well, as you know, the Ulster identity is a really complicated one, and it was the same with Lewis. I mean, he always identified himself personally as Irish. I looked into this recently for my talk in Ireland to make sure I had my ducks in a row about it. And yeah, he definitely kind of he identified personally as Irish, but he also kind of used his English identity and the fluidity of a Northern Irish identity to his advantage, in the sense that, you know, people would know him for years in Oxford, and they never knew he was Irish, or he never talked about being Irish. He would have still had a slight accent, but he didn't speak openly or very frequently about his Irish identity as an adult. So that's pretty interesting. And I think part of that is that he didn't want to be penned as an Irish writer. He says something to Arthur Greaves very early on, his good friend from Northern Ireland. And Greaves is thinking about, you know, where to publish his book. And Lewis advises him not to be too closely or tightly associated as an Irish writer, because then, you know, you're kind of pigeonholed. So I think that's kind of revealing. He himself felt very strongly that he wanted to identify with the broadest, most universally appealing literature, and that's what he strove for. So that's very interesting. But as far as the book goes, I mean, I talk about him being an Ulster contrarian in the sense that this kind of going back to this persona that he had of being a loud, kind of aggressive, masculine, big talking guy at Oxford. This is kind of part of his persona when he's dealing with especially colleagues. A lot of people comment on this like persona of his. And he himself talks about being a contrarian in the sense that and a controversialist. In the sense that this is a role he's picking up and playing with as a literary figure.
The stereotype of the Ulster contrarian is not always very attractive. How did Lewis's colleagues in Oxford respond to that kind of persona that he projected?
Well, I think it has to be remembered that Lewis knew very large number of people, lots of people crossed his path, and lots of people really admired him and responded really well to him. He was very funny. He could, you know, be very warm. He could be very congenial. But he could also be quite rough. He could be harsh. He could be, especially if you were on the wrong side of things in literary matters. If you were a student of his and you were trying to defend modernist literature, mm-hmm. forget it. He could be incredibly rough in that situation. And by rough, I mean he was an expert in rhetoric. He was an expert in words, and his memory was really amazing, and he could just talk you under the table. And a lot of people in this culture this was part of Oxbridge culture, this ability to be incredibly witty, and to, you know, out-debate the other guy. But in Lewis's case, he had a tendency to take that a bit too far. He had a tendency to be dismissive, and, you know, he gained a reputation for this. This is like around, it's really in the circles of Oxford. It's kind of in the politics of his college. So it's kind of a small group that I'm talking about. But yeah.
There's a really interesting section in the book about his involvement in college politics and the ways in which the ironies in that in many respects. You mentioned there his hostility to literary modernism. And I think there's a passage in the book where he has some very negative things to say about T.S. Eliot. And then later on, you reflect on the fact that he and T.S. Eliot, I think, worked cooperatively in a new Bible translation, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. I mean, and that's a good point to remember about this. Like, I felt it was my job to kind of excavate this kind of neglected history around Lewis's reception among his peers, but it was very fluid, and it's easy to exaggerate hostilities. He was very harsh on T.S. Eliot and wrote publicly and privately about that. He was also publicly critical of Roy Campbell. And he and John Betjeman had a really difficult relationship. But, you know, this is talking about decades, and feelings change over decades. This is a very small world. And yeah, he worked with Eliot later. And, you know, I went back and looked at, I found later that, you know, I tried to balance out the perception that he's rough with his peers to say, well, and then a lot of people who spoke really badly about him would say, look, I mean, we also cared about each other. Like, we butt heads, but that doesn't mean that we, you know, universally hated each other. So it's a small world, and it's very political, and it's kind of difficult to get at from this distance. But it took a little, some careful kind of excavation to kind of explain the dynamics at work.
Sure. There is a tendency, as you just observed, to exaggerate conflict in some of the reconstructions of Lewis's life and context. But there's also, you point out in the book, there's also a tendency to overly romanticize other aspects of his life, including his relationship with Joy Gresham.
Yes, that's true. And this was a good example of the fact that it's not just Americans who are romanticizing Lewis. The British audiences tend to do that as well. Shadowlands came out in 1985, and that was based on an American account of Lewis's relationship with Joy Davidman Gresham, an American woman that he wrote letters with, and then that developed into romantic love, and he married her. And Shadowlands came out, and it was first a play, and then a television. Maybe it was I'm going to get my facts wrong. I think it was a television play. It was a play, then a television show, and then it was remade by Hollywood into a big budget movie. So that was an interesting new recasting of Lewis's life, and definitely kept him before the public once again.
Hmm. And it's a much more palatable view of that part of his life than perhaps other sources might suggest.
Yes, it kind of presents a very cozy life that's interrupted by the big, brash American woman and romantic love. It didn't quite happen like that. And there's definitely a darker side to that story. There was a new biography of Joy David McGresham that I benefited from that showed that actually Joy very intentionally pursued Lewis as a way of getting out of her marriage and securing a visa. And but that, again, that's not to say that there wasn't real love there. It's just more complicated than we like to make movies out of.
Of course. So here we are. It's 2018. It's, 55 years or so after Lewis's death. How many books does he sell at the minute? Is he still a popular author?
He's still a popular author. And part of that is, most of that is the Lewis, the Narnia franchise. The Silver Chair is currently being made into another Narnia movie that's expected in probably 2020. So the Lewis interest continues. And American Christians still find him really useful. And as I mentioned, British Christians have, you know, suddenly kind of a renewed respect and interest of him because American Christians have been exporting him through their, you know, kind of newfound, and by newfound, I mean post-war, American influence grows in the post-war years globally, and therefore Lewis is kind of exported with that new influence. So yeah, it's a ongoing and changing phenomenon, but it certainly does not seem to be abating.
And there are some steady sellers in the Lewis back catalogue, as well as some new books. I saw recently C.S. Lewis on Prayer, which I think is a new compilation of various essays, I think one or two of which hadn't been published before. But which of his books sell the best at the moment?
The Chronicles of Narnia are always the best sellers. Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is steady. And then Mere Christianity would be the next most popular. Those are consistently big sellers.
Well, it's such a fascinating book. There's so many different representations of Lewis in it. It's such a rich study. If you're going to summarize all of this, Stephanie, how should we remember C.S. Lewis now?
Yeah, I mean, I find it a really interesting subject because there are so many different facets to Lewis. And I think one of the best ways that we can remember him is somebody that's engaged with his time. You know, he wasn't one-dimensional. He was very multidimensional. That's what makes him so interesting and engaging. But he was a man of his times, engaged with his times. And I think that's something that Christian readers, especially of Lewis, would do well to remember, that he is speaking to, you know, a Britain and not America of the 30s, 40s, 50s. And he's not speaking to our time. And I think that, you know, he's also somebody that did what he wanted to do. I think that that's something that, especially people who are engaged with the mind and with writing, that's something I think that we long for, because we are often pigeonholed, especially as academics, into one little circle in our world. And we write on that subject and we write for other academic audiences. And for many of us, we have a lot of interest and we would like to engage with many different topics. And Lewis did that because his times kind of afforded that more than they do today. Mm. So I think that that's kind of part of why others of us kind of romanticize Lewis, because he could write could and did write whatever he wanted to. There was pushback in his day, but it was still a time where he could be afforded that liberty. So, yeah, it's kind of difficult to sum up, but yeah, he was certainly of his moment.
Well, Stephanie, we've taken up a lot of your time today, and thanks for giving us this time during your book tour. But before we wind up, could you tell us what you're working on at the moment, please?
Sure. I'm looking at the history of publishing, actually, because I found that this was an area that's not been done very well for, especially history of Christian publishing. So that's what I'm engaged in right now, as well as kind of try to publish some of these things that I found written about Lewis that haven't been published before. So, yeah.
Great, great. Well, Stephanie Derrick, author of The Fame of C.S. Lewis, just published with Oxford University Press, thanks so much for coming on to the show. And thank you for writing this book. Thanks for your time and take care.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.